Welcome to the Boston College Chief Executives Club podcast of the June 17th, 2020 forum featuring Jim Fitterling, Chairman and CEO of Dow. I'm Warren Zola, the Executive Director of the Chief Executives Club. The Boston College Chief Executives Club, a program of the Carroll School of Management, is one of the top-ranked CEO speaking forums in the world. Several times each year, Boston's business leaders gather to learn from CEOs of global companies, leaders from the top echelons of their fields, who welcome the opportunity to address an audience of their peers. Jim Fitterling joined us for a series we call Conversations with CEOs as he spoke with me and engaged in a Q&A with our members. The conversation focused on Dow's response to COVID-19, his leadership, and incredible commitment to diversity and inclusion. We're absolutely thrilled today to welcome the chairman and CEO of Dow, Jim Fitterling, to join us today. While we wish it was in person, we're really ecstatic that you're able to take the time to join us by Zoom and share some of the excitement of both your background, leadership, and what Dow's been doing. So Jim, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Warren, for the invitation. And I'm also sorry I'm not able to be there in person, and you're not able to have this in person, but we'll get through this, and I think we'll get to a more normal future here soon.
I hope so. I think that we all need it mentally as well. But again, really, really appreciative of you being here today. Again, it's my honor to introduce Jim, Chairman and CEO of Dow. Jim has been CEO of Dow for just about 2 years and was named Chairman of the Board earlier this year, so congratulations. Jim's a lifelong Dow employee, joining the company as a technical sales rep just weeks after earning his mechanical engineering degree from the University of Missouri. He worked his way up, having served in various leadership positions throughout the company. There are two areas, however, that I'd like to highlight that aren't as clear if you do just a quick Google search on Jim's background, and they're important, and I'd like to call your attention to them. First is the enormous impact that Jim has had throughout his career on Dow's strategy and transformation. As one of Dow's most senior and globally experienced leaders, he's played a critical role in developing and executing the company's strategy to invest in a market-driven portfolio of advantaged and technology-enabled businesses around the globe. Without his direction and guidance, Dow's physical footprint, as well as its position as one of the world's leading material sciences companies, would be far different. In fact, it would probably be quite a bit smaller. Related to that, you should know that he is the strongest proponent for innovation within the company and the catalyst behind digitalizing the organization so it can be more effective, more efficient, and more relevant for customers. His attention to the company's future is clear. Dow must innovate market-driven, sustainable solutions for the world's toughest challenges. It can only do that with both the technical expertise and an innovative mindset. The second area that I'm excited to point out, likewise, is difficult to overstate, and it's his tremendous drive to make Dow a more inclusive and diverse organization. And while Jim and others on this call have talked about the importance of diversity being good for business, we know that he's a strong believer in the moral principle for treating every employee with respect. As a frequent speaker at LGBT conferences around the nation, he often talks about his own coming out story and how liberating it was for him to be accepted by his peers and colleagues. He's using that experience to help Dow institutionalize an inclusive culture. To begin to understand how well-regarded he is, know this. Every year, the Financial Times publishes a list of global executives who are most influential in creating safe workplace environments for LGBT employees. Over the past several years, Jim has been ranked either number one or number two on that list. It's a true testament to his reputation, his vocal support, and visible and active work towards building inclusive workplaces and inclusive communities. All of this is difficult to discern just doing a Wikipedia entry, but it's why we're so excited to have Jim here today to talk about these areas and these issues of importance to us. So once again, Jim, thank you so much for joining us.
I'm glad to be here, Warren. Thank you for the nice introduction and the kind words.
Yeah, sorry. It winds up being lengthy, and I don't want to take away from your time with our members, but I also think it's really important to underscore the impact that you've had at Dow. And I am going to turn our attention to Dow in a second, but I love to start off by focusing on how your company has been impacted by our current situation, right? It's been 3 or 4 months, and how has the pandemic impacted Dow and how you operate?
Dow sells products in almost every country in the world. And we like to say the business of chemistry touches almost 98% of everything that you use every day. And so we see a lot that's happening in the global markets. I would say that the lockdowns and the shutdowns of non-essential manufacturing has had a big impact on us. So if you look at things like construction, automobiles, transportation, they're all high demand uses of our products, furniture, appliances. And then on the other end of the spectrum, you've got things like packaging for food, health and hygiene products, industrial intermediates that go into cleaning chemicals, solvents, things that you use every day at home. It's kind of a tale of two worlds. Those high, big ticket items, high dollar items have really dramatically dropped. And it doesn't matter what country in the world you were in. In China, you know, when the pandemic happened in Wuhan, and they started to lock down the economy there, automotive sales in China dropped 90% in the first month. And then they started to rebound and come back. Same thing happened here. Automotive sales saw a massive drop. The only thing that was happening was really online. And now they're starting to come back. I think in the month of June, we've seen automotive retail sales up about 40%. But there's still a lot of pressure in that chain. Capital spending is way off. So you can imagine capital spending drives a lot of growth for us, whether you're talking about commercial buildings or new construction for homes, that has been off. And I'd say on the construction side, what we see is that projects that were underway are getting completed, but projects that hadn't been started, there's a lag in permits and certification to get projects started. That's going to take a while to catch up. So I think, you know, for 2020, we're looking at completion of existing projects, but starting of new projects is probably a 2021 type of thing. We are starting to see the United States and Europe come back a bit. April and May were the toughest 2 months. June has been a little bit better. In fact, in June, if we look at sequential month over month order book, June is up in almost every business that we have. That was not the case in April and May. But we still got a long way to go because in some market segments, essentially they went to zero and we're in kind of a big reset and we're starting over. And then there's been some other positives, like the digital part of the economy has been good. Digital channels have performed relatively well versus other channels. Do-it-yourself business on our paint and coatings business has been good, probably the best it's been in 10 years. On the other side, contractor painting has been relatively low. So it's a mixed bag. And it's improving, but it's uneven. And we're just kind of taking it week by week and month by month and trying to adapt our production to that demand.
And I don't know, according to what I was looking at, it looks like you have 109 or so manufacturing sites in 31 countries, 7,000 employees. The logistics of sort of operating across all of that bureaucracy, all of the different ways that COVID has impacted different countries must also be a unique challenge in addition to the sales and the general, workflow.
Yeah. Well, we have a lot of experience in those countries. In many of the countries where we operate, we've been there for decades. So we have a team on the ground that is really a local team that understands the local issues. I would say we also have about 10,000, maybe a little bit more contractors that help support us on those sites. And so we're dealing with that dynamic too. I would say the experience that we've got on the ground has helped us navigate through it. And then obviously being in Asia and the experience of having the pandemic experience there first has helped us prepare in Europe and in the United States and in Latin America for what was coming. And so we've seen, obviously, a lot of leverage around the company. We've been a very globally connected company for a long time. For the last 30 years, global trade has really brought us closer together. And this world, from a petrochemical standpoint, global trade flattened this world a long time ago. And so we've got a lot of digital capabilities to stay connected with each other. And we were able to move pretty seamlessly to a work from home schedule. So we've got 14,000 employees that show up every day at the sites to keep product moving. Mm. And we've got 22,000 that are working from home every day and communicating just like this and keeping everything running for our customers. And it's been challenging, but it's been good. In some ways, we're more connected than we ever have been. You know, seeing each other and having communication sessions like this versus email exchanges is a different level of communication. So some ways we're closer together than we ever have been.
It's really remarkable to think about, you know, obviously how business is changing for everybody, but it sounds like Dow was positioned reasonably well before this hit because of your relationships where you were around the world, and you've migrated to this new world reasonably seamlessly, at least from what you're saying and what I've read.
Yeah, I'm very happy with the way everybody adjusted. We were just talking earlier today with the employees. We posted our best ever customer experience scores in the second quarter. And I think one of the reasons we did was when the pandemic hit, you saw on two levels, you saw demand either collapsing or panic buying that was driving demand through the roof. And we got really close to our customers to make sure that we could keep up with them and keep up with the just a step change of increase that they saw in the demand for their products. You know, you have people making hand sanitizers whose volumes grew 4 to 5x what they normally were. People making home and personal care products and cleaners and disinfectants. You know, all of that put a big strain on the supply chain. And so our teams were able to lean in and help them out and do some things on the fly that I think are just ingrained in Dow. I mean, we had a team down in Texas City, did a small modification to one of the plants that almost doubled the production of IPA, which is a key ingredient for hand sanitizer. And they did it literally on the fly. And because they had to, and they found a way to do it, we developed two or three forms of PPE that we actually helped take to the market, kind of level two medical gowns, face shields that we worked with one of our plastics customers on. In that case, we did an open source design for a simple face shield that was just a plastic shield that had a way to fasten in the back and a polyurethane headband in the front of it. And you'll see them in use all over if you're going to get healthcare these days. And then we worked with Whirlpool and Reynolds, two of our longtime customers, to make some respirators, some positive air purifying respirators that we donated through one of Whirlpool's outlets, Wynn Health Labs, to hospitals in Michigan and Texas and Louisiana to help them get through. All of this happened like in a matter of like 2 to 3 weeks. And that's the nature of the kind of business that we do and the kind of business that we're in.
It's remarkable to think about this sort of global effort by so many and so many companies that are pulling together to fight. So it's heartening to hear that the sort of the recognition that we're all in this together and people are addressing the supply chain and all these things that need to be done. I want to shift gears a little bit. I think Dow has been known for having a history of sort of doing good, if you will. The founder, Herbert H. Dow, was famous for saying, quote, if you can't do it better, why do it? How does sort of that history of Dow's engagement in doing well affect your sort of style and leadership skills and what you're trying to bring Dow in today?
Yeah, you know, Dow's history, back to Herbert H. Dow, was trying to either improve a process or improve a quality of life through the products that they made. The beginning of the company was chlorine for bleach, but also bromine and iodine for the medical industry, and a revolutionary process and a low-cost process to do that. But there's also a long sustainability history there. He made a lot of products out of recycled materials back in his early days. There was a lot of innovation, a lot of investment in R&D throughout. And working with, you know, some leading edge counterparts in inventing new ways of doing things, Dow and Westinghouse held some of the earliest patents on cogeneration in the industry. We're a big energy user, and that was one of the ways to get power and steam at low cost. And so they developed the concept of cogeneration years ago. So there's a long history there. And we continue to work on that at site. I think the people that know us and that work with us understand what we can do from an innovation standpoint. I'm not sure sometimes the general public shares all that, but I do think it is a good story. And there's a culture here that looks at challenges and looks at tough issues and looks at tough times as an opportunity to really buckle down and figure out a different way to do things. I kind of call that the find a way mentality, and we have a way of doing that. And you know, I think when times are tough, that's when your culture and your DNA really shows through, because that's what carries people through. They go back to the basics and they go back to the fundamentals. And right now, that's what's carrying us through. And we've had to deal with it. We've had to deal with the pandemic, the economic collapse. We had a flood here in Midland that was a 500-year flood that, you know, forced 12,000 people to evacuate. And yet we've navigated all that. And people's heads are up, and we're figuring out how to come out the back end of this stronger than we went into it.
That's great. I want to come back to sustainability. I should welcome the folks who have just joined us now. Again, we've got the chair and CEO of Dow, Jim Fitterling, who's joined us today. This session will end at 1:15 promptly, as we always do with the CEO Club, and we will certainly have time for member questions. So start using the chat, and we'll open it up to member questions in a little bit. But let's return to sustainability. If you Google Dow at all, you're going to show up with the word sustainable, and some of the efforts that you have led and Dow has promised in those areas. Dow has a goal of, quote, being the most innovative, customer-centric, inclusive, and sustainable material science company in the world, which is certainly a lofty mission. But following up in that goal, last week you announced aggressive new commitments to address climate change and plastic waste. Can you tell us about these new sustainability targets that you guys unveiled last week?
We're a large energy user, and so carbon dioxide emissions is a big target on protecting the climate. And we have to continue to grow our business, but we can't just do it at any cost. From 2006 to 2019, we were able to grow the business and still reduce greenhouse gas emissions by about 15%. And so we announced kind of two goals on protecting the climate. By 2030, we're going to still grow the business, but reduce our emissions by another 15%. And by 2050, we intend to be carbon neutral. Carbon neutral, looking at all of our scope 1, 2, and 3 emissions, plus also working on a way to take into account the product benefits that our products generate. So if you can imagine, we make a lot of materials that go into building and construction, insulation, which help make an energy efficient economy and lower CO2 footprint. So we've got to look at a way to account for some of that. That's a big goal. And we also announced some actions toward that goal. We said that we would have by 2025, our target was to have 750 megawatts of alternative energy power. To give you an idea of that, we are one of the top 25 alternative energy users in the world, and we are the top in our industry. We're already 2/3 of that goal, so we'll surpass the 750 megawatts of alternative energy power. But we can't replace all of our energy with alternative energy. It isn't reliable and dispatchable enough. I can't afford a dropout on energy of more than a millisecond, and so my grid has to be very robust and very strong. a lot of the energy we use today requires natural gas to produce it. So we've got to find more efficient processes and different ways of making products. We're looking at, can we electrify an ethylene cracker, for example? So we're working with Shell to see if that makes sense. We're going to work on that in Europe and see if that can make sense. We're working on process technologies that we think can reduce the CO2 emissions on the conventional process by as much as 20 to 40%. Those are big step change improvements. The other side we're working on is on plastics. We're one of the largest plastics producers in the world. A lot of our plastics go into packaging, elastomer materials that go into construction, all kinds of things, footwear. But two things that we've been trying to do and we've put a lot of effort into are stopping the waste and closing the loop. Stopping the waste is more than just stopping the plastic waste. It's about infrastructure and it's about behaviors. You've got to find a way. People for years have been in a linear economy where they use something and their natural response is to throw it away versus to recycle it. And in a lot of places, recycle won't even take some of the plastics materials because they can't find a market for it. It's cheaper to make virgin plastic than to recycle plastic. So we have to create that circular economy, and we're doing it two ways. We're doing it, one, through demand pull with brand owners who will use more post-consumer recycle materials. And then another way, we're going to have to do it through different schemes that we'll have to work with governments on, like enhanced producer responsibility schemes that make it economical to do the recycle. The other thing we're trying to do is close the loop. And on close the loop, essentially make sure that everything that we design for a customer who makes a package or a product has the potential to be fully recyclable. So one of our targets is every product that we make that we sell into package by 2035 has to be completely recyclable. That's more complicated than it sounds because most of the packages you buy are complex structures made out of two or three different materials. It's not easy once they've been formulated to take them apart. But if every plastic starts with a catalyst, so if you can make a homogeneous plastic with the right properties, you don't have to have a complicated structure to do it. And if we can retool our whole portfolio that way, then that will feed not only closing the loop, but also stopping the waste. So the two go hand in hand. We said we wanted to have 1 million metric tons of waste post-consumer recycle material back to plastics again, and we're well on our way to do that. And we've also been one of the five resin companies that were the founding partners for the Alliance to End Plastic Waste, which is an NGO that is a value chain participation, brand owners, recyclers, waste management companies, packaging converters, resin producers, and NGO partners who have amassed a $1.5 billion fund to actually go out on the ground, mostly right now focused on Southeast Asia, and implement models like Recycle Facility of the Future that can drive both collection and recovery of these materials and solve the waste issue, waste going to the ocean issue long term. So we believe both of these are important. They go hand in hand. Carbon, climate, and plastics go hand in hand with each other. And that's why they're front and center for our new goals.
Yeah, I mean, I read through the sustainability reports and your goals and talking about the circular economy in trying to sort of do what you can for the environment and closing the loop. What are some of the impediments that you think, I mean, and you say that, you know, this sounds easy to have this done in, you know, 10 or 15 years. And it certainly doesn't to me, but it certainly sounds incredibly complex and challenging. What are some of the impediments that other companies or other political environments are having in terms of impeding this movement so that, you know, it is terrific to have individual companies doing this, but how do we get more, make a larger impact on a global scale? What are some of the challenges that people are facing?
I think we have to, use the capitalist model to really incentivize the circular economy. Most of the activity in this area has been about regulating things out of existence or banning things out of existence. And it isn't logical to, like, say, the average person on the street. But one of the ways we've been able to grow the economy and the reasons that plastics has grown the way it has is because it's actually been a positive for CO2 emissions. If you were to replace all the plastics that the world uses today, whether it's in automobiles or whether it's in packaging, with metal or glass or wood or one of the other alternatives, your CO2 emissions would go up and your amount of waste would go up 4 to 5 times. So you'd still have a waste problem. You have a worse CO2 problem. That isn't necessarily logical to people that that's the case, but that's the case. So if you just tax these things and ban them out of existence, you generate a lot of tax money for a while until the industry's gone. But that tax money hasn't historically gone to solving the problem. It's really gone, it's just disappeared into the general coffers, and it hasn't really created the circular economy. And I talked earlier about producer responsibility schemes. If you want to create the circular economy, capitalism can be on your side to create that, but you've got to come up with a way to do it. So one of the simplest examples I would give is a PET bottle, like this Gatorade bottle or a water bottle. In Michigan, 20 some odd years ago, they started to put a 10-cent deposit on bottles like this, or a 5-cent deposit in some states. And you took them back to the retailer, and when you put them in the reverse vending machine, you got your credit back at the store. But what came out of the back of the store was a bundled up bale of PET bottles that was a pretty good raw material to go into a recycling facility to go back to bottles again. So that's an example of something that changes a culture and a behavior. So now it's just second nature in Michigan that you buy these, you're taking them back and you're getting your money back. And it's created a close the loop type of mentality. We have to create more of that, because most people today think, well, I'm throwing this piece of plastic away because it can't be recycled. Some of it can be recycled. There is just no mechanism today for it to efficiently get back into the stream and get recycled. And by the way, if it does go back in to a waste management company, a lot of the waste management companies, the cheapest thing for them to do is to landfill it. You know, it's maybe 3 cents a pound to landfill it. It might be twice that to convert it. So what we're trying to do is really develop a circular economy. It's not as easy as it sounds, but you've got to get a model that works, and then you've got to try to replicate that model in as many places as you can. It takes government, government at the very local level, but it also takes some good economics and some good business skills to put it in place. And it takes technology, and that's where an industry like ours comes in. We know how to do things at scale. And so once we can get a model and we need to do it at scale, we can get it replicated. In Indonesia right now, the Alliance is working on a 500,000 ton per year facility to take waste of a lot of different materials. It's waste to energy, it's mechanical recycling, and it's advanced recycling to take plastics back to a monomer level. And if we can do that, in the community that we've got today, there is no facility for some of this waste. So we've not only solved a waste management issue and eliminated that much material from potentially going to the ocean, we've created energy for a small community. We've created byproducts that can go back into the circular economy. If the Alliance can stand up a model like that and lend some low-cost money in there to get it going, then we can have the community and other investors take it over, and then we can go replicate that someplace else. That's what we're trying to do. It's not a trivial task, but it is something that can be accomplished if we work together.
Okay, I'm going to switch gears, and then because I really like to delve into a little bit about diversity and inclusion. And after that, we'll take some questions from our audience. But you've been such a strong proponent for diversity and inclusion personally and as CEO of Dow. How has that sort of shaped your perspective and your leadership style at Dow? Clearly, it's been incredibly successful for you. Tell us a little bit about how it's impacted you.
Yeah, well, one of the reasons, I'm sorry, one of the reasons that I joined Dow in the first place was the people. and the culture. And it was a very collegial place to work, and it was very open. You could talk to anybody in the company. You could talk to anybody at any level in the company without fear of reprisal. And that was just the nature of the way we did things. And even for being a small Midwestern company, you'd be surprised at how progressive Dow is. You know, being based here in Midland, Michigan, most people would think, oh, you know, you're in the flyover states and, you know, you can't be as progressive as maybe on the coast, but you'd be surprised. I grew up in a time where, you know, and in the middle of Missouri where, you know, coming out was just not popular. And if you did, you would expose yourself to a lot of discrimination. And at that time, there was no protection anywhere for being out and being gay. I have to say that Dow for 20 years has had sexual orientation in its diversity practices. So it wouldn't fire somebody for that. But that in and of itself doesn't eliminate some of the concerns people have for coming out. So about 6 years ago, about 10 years ago, I was diagnosed with stage 4 cancer. And as I was recovering from that, one of the things I said to myself was, you know, there are some stresses and some things I need to eliminate in my personal life. And one of them is the stress and the toll that it takes of trying to live a personal life that's separate from your professional life. I did it for a long time. It isn't easy. And as I was moving up through the company and preparing to be COO, I said, look, you're in a small town in Midland, Michigan. You need to be out. And at the time, a lot of people were being outed. And I said, look, that's not the way I want to come out. I would like to manage my own message. I would like to be a positive thing. Dow had 20 years, at that time, had almost 15 years of history with our GLAAD organization. So I talked to them, and we made an event on Coming Out Day in 2014, where I came out on a webcast to, at the time, this was before the Dow-DuPont merger and everything, 53,000 employees. And I would tell you it was a big event, an emotional event, but it also lifted the discussion level. It allowed us to have much more courageous conversations at the company. And people say, well, you know, you had 20 years of GLAAD orientation. What makes the difference? Let's say you're a young gay employee at the company and you see somebody that's a COO at the company and you know they're gay, but you know they're not out. What's the message to you as the leader of that company? And what message are you sending to everybody else? I'm gay, I'm not out. So what should you do? Stay in the closet? Should you be afraid to come out here? Is this not an inviting environment? That my step kind of lifted the lid on that discussion and took us to another level. It also tackled something which I think is important to understand, is that we had board support. I was in the process of becoming COO, and Andrew Livers was my boss at the time, and said to me, you know, if you're worried about this, you should go talk individually to each one of the board members about what they think about it. And so I did. I went to see every one of them, and they all said to a person, you're doing the right thing. We're proud of you, and we're 100% behind you. This is the right thing to do, the right time to do it, and you've got our full support. So the board's supportive. I can be out and open. Now the next thing you got to do is make sure that everybody in the organization is supportive. And that's the same thing that we're trying to tackle right now with racial injustice and racial inequality, is making sure that we have an environment where there aren't microaggressions and other types of biases in the organization that are causing issues with the African-American community inside Dow, but also outside Dow. Dow, most people would not think this. Dow has been working on, Dow has offered same-sex benefits to employees for 15 years in a row now. We've scored 100% on the HRC, Corporate Equality Index, for 15 years in a row. We started that work 20 years ago. We have people in Dow that were part of writing the amicus brief on the marriage ruling from the Supreme Court. We have people in Dow that were part of the work that was done for the most recent Supreme Court ruling. We've worked on ENDA. We're trying to take what we know about advocacy from that perspective and apply that from a standpoint of racial inequality and racial injustice, make sure that we're creating a better environment for our own African-American employees, employees of all minority races, but also doing what we can publicly through communities and through policy changes to help make that a sustainable, inclusive environment.
I mean, that's all, it's wonderful to hear both about Dow's history and then some of your efforts on behalf of Dow. And to tie it to what's happening with racial inequalities, last week, our Zoom session, we had Linda Henry from the Boston Globe and Carol Fulp of Fulp Diversity, both of whom I think are here today. And we talked about racial injustice. And one of the things I think is really important, and you touched upon this a little bit, and I'd love for your comments on this, and then we'll open up to questions. And I think Suzanne Bates is up first. I'm on the board of an organization called You Can Play. It's a nonprofit that promotes LGBTQ safety in sports and allows everyone to play regardless of sexual orientation or gender identity. And one of the things that's really important to that organization, it sounds like that's what's where Dow is heading, both on all of your diversity and inclusion efforts, has to do with the importance of allyship, right? And that's something that's going to help get us through all of these inequalities. It's going to help us address the some of the barriers to inclusion. How important have allies been to you and to Dow? It sounds like you got some support from the board, but I'd love to hear you talk a little bit about the importance of allies, because something that we can all do to make all of our organizations more inclusive.
Allies are everything. And I'll use the LGBTQ experience and then also translate that into some of our other employee resource groups. Our LGBTQ employee resource group is the second largest in the company after the women's, the gender resource group. It's also the second oldest. It has 80% allies as membership. If you go to an event, you have no idea, you know, who at the event is LGBTQ or not, because it just is a very diverse intermixing of everybody, and it's very open dialogue, open discussion. They'll tackle anything. Segue over to, I'm the executive sponsor today for Dow's Global African Affinity Network. And one of the things a few years ago, before we put Karen Carter in place as our chief inclusion officer, one of the things we looked at was our employee resource groups. And one of the things we could tell was that with our women's group, our Hispanic Latin group, our African American group, our Middle Eastern intercultural group, they largely were just that ethnicity or just that gender and no allies. And one of the things we were trying to do was drive more participation in ERGs, because we could see that employees who were engaged in ERGs were more engaged in the company and were more loyal to the company, and they felt better and felt like they belonged and were contributing. So we said, we've got to get allies into this equation. For the African American population, it was critical to get allies in, because in many cases, it was the white population that could control the decisions that would give opportunities for advancement to that community. And if the African American and African Affinity Network was meeting and talking about their own issues and nobody else was hearing that, who could make changes in policies or practices or could step up and advocate for one of them, then you have a real problem. So we did that. Our ERG participation went from 18% in the company to 42%. And that was allies and people signing up to be parts of those networks. That made a huge difference. But that in itself doesn't change unless people take action. And so the other thing we did was we said, we're going to have people leaders be responsible for representation numbers in the company. We've had diversity metrics for a long, long time, but we never made it part of anybody's performance. Most of our performance metrics at the company level, at the management level, were always financial. It was a return on capital, total shareholder return, maybe a profit goal like EBITDA, that was the metric, or cash flow, that was the metric. Nothing else. So this year we put in 20% of the performance metrics, our ESG metrics, and representation is part of that. And if you saw the sustainability report, it's very transparent. It's very transparent about gender and gender pay equity. It's very transparent about diversity. And right now, the top 300 people leaders in the company have that baked into their goals. And the objective is, you know, we want to prove it out and make sure we can manage it properly, but eventually we'll take it to all 3,000 people leaders in the company.
That's terrific. I mean, I'm impressed with your efforts and Dow's efforts on this issue. And I think that having a company like Dow taking the lead in this is going to be a great beacon for others to follow. And certainly that's our hope. Again, the opportunity is now to switch over and let some of our members ask questions. We've got Suzanne Bates is up first, and we'll hand the floor to you. And Carol Fulp, the aforementioned Carol Fulp from Fulp Diversity, seems to have a question. She will follow Suzanne. But Suzanne, if you want to go ahead and unmute yourself and ask Jim his question.
Hi, Jim. Well, we've known each other a long time, and I just want to congratulate you again because your courageous step to share your story was transformative for the culture of Dow. But it wasn't just the story. It was what you've done since then to put muscle behind it. I'm thinking that Carol's story might be, or Carol's question might be a little more in the stream of the conversation right now, because I know she's asking about the importance of diversity to innovation. And my question, perhaps you want to answer that first. My question after that is, I'd love to get your perspective on the global economic recovery and what you think are some of the factors, the most important factors in the recovery.
Sure. Look, I think on the recovery, most of the impact of what's happened to the economy right now has been from the pandemic. And what we've seen is that the places that really actively tried to flatten the curve on the pandemic and were successful and then gradually reopened with the right proactive steps like face coverings and screening and sanitization and hand washing and social distancing are doing pretty well. And those that aren't are having a tough time. So if we want the economy recovery to keep going, we're going to have to change our behaviors a little bit, because you know, we can control some of this. The virus is still there. I mean, it hasn't changed, but our behaviors have changed. As we've reopened, everybody's said, oh, you know, I can just go back to the way it was before. Well, not necessarily so. So we have an element of control in terms of how the economy recovers. And if we can't, then the governments are going to have to shut things down to get it under control again. That, I think, is the biggest question mark out there right now. It's why the market, I think, moves every time, you know, a virus good news or bad news comes out. You see the market swing like it has. To Carol's question, you know, on diversity and inclusion,
we can bring Carol right on if let her ask that. Carol, do you want to join us?
Thanks, and Suzanne, thanks for giving me the entry to that. Warren, thank you for having Jim. Jim, first and foremost, thank you for your courage, for coming out and for being yourself. And I also want to thank you for the thought-provoking communique you sent in the wake of the racial protests that has been going on. It took a lot of courage to share your statistics with others and to indicate that Dow was committed to do better. The fact that you are linking your commitment to dollars, to one's pay, the fact that you're linking diversity to one's business performance is critical and certainly is a model for others to follow. Can you share with us why diversity is so critical to innovation? Dow is so innovative. How do you see diversity in helping Dow be so innovative?
Well, I think the ultimate form of diversity is just diversity of thought. And if you're excluding different thoughts and different perspectives from the way you develop new products or the way you tackle a process problem or the way you tackle this, look at the way you tackle this pandemic. This pandemic hasn't affected everybody the same. You've got to have a lot of different voices at the table. And we focused on inclusion because we want to create a culture where people feel like they belong and they can contribute and they can be part of driving the company and driving the solution. Diversity is important. You have to measure representation. You have to have representation. But we have seen over history that we can drive numbers on diversity, but we can't always sustain them. And our feeling is if you want to sustain it, you've got to have the culture that's inclusive. And then, you know, in a few other areas that are maybe a little bit more granular, we sell products into many consumer brand companies. And so we actually use some of our employee resource groups right now to test products that we're prototyping for consumer brand companies. I was in Europe last year, or early this year before this all happened. And we were working on a whole line of bio-based hair care products that happened to be part of them were for the African community. And we were using our African Affinity Network to actually give us feedback on some of the formulations that we were working on for that product. So there are some very, very direct business opportunities there. But I think the most part is if I want the best answers, I've got to have the best brains. The best brains aren't all the same race and aren't all the same ethnicity. And they've got to have an environment that they feel like they're part and that they're willing to contribute. And that means that we're going out of our way to engage them and give them chances for opportunity and chances to be engaged.
Thank you.
That's great. And thank you, Carol, for the question. We seem to have one more question from Barry Sloan, so I'll turn it over to Barry, and then we'll probably head to our lightning round unless we have any more questions. So Barry, if you want to unmute yourself and join us.
Thank you, Warren. Jim, welcome. Can I ask your perspective? I know this was before your time or began before your time, but how you now reflect on the whole dioxin Agent Orange epic, you know, insofar as the damage, you know, the death and destruction to our own troops and the non-combatants, and the, as you know, the decades it took for Dow to take some responsibility for it. What do you think you would have done differently in that epic?
Well, that's a tough question, Barry. I would say, you know, you're talking about a wartime environment. And during that time, you know, Dow made the two products that were blended to make Agent Orange. But during that time, essentially, you know, the government came in and wanted to make those materials for those purposes. You know, I think today you look back and say, knowing what you know, would you enter into that arrangement again? That might be easy to say. On the other hand, there was also a strong drive from the government to take over that manufacturing to make that product. So I don't know if I would be able to answer how I would change it again. We haven't been faced with that. I haven't seen anything close to that in my career.
Thank you.
Okay. We have one more question having to talk about the mindset for D&I work from Victor Swint. So Victor, please join us, and the floor is yours.
Hey, Jim, thanks a lot for your story. It's really inspirational. And I also looked at your website and saw that your team is quite diverse. So congratulations. As you were, as your company was embarking on this process to drive inclusion in your company, oftentimes that goes counter to previous thinking on the meritocracy and this and that, all these other kind of thoughts that could hinder the efforts. How did you sensitize the white males to privilege, to cultural differences, and to also their role to make a difference? Was it purely financial, or was there also education and a process that you went through?
Yeah, and I wish I could say that we had done all of that. I think it's still an ongoing educational process. I mean, it's one of the things that has come to the front lately is people just don't have a real understanding of what white privilege is or what it means. And so I would say two things that helped us. One was that we've always been an international company, and that goes back to, well, Herbert H. Dow was Canadian and came to the U.S. to start the company. Not that that's a big chasm, but we've grown internationally, so we're in almost every continent. And the international perspective has helped, because there are places that are more open-minded about it than the United States had been traditionally. So that helped. It didn't always help from a gender diversity standpoint, because you would have pockets where gender was fine. Like, we never had a problem with gender diversity in a place like China, for example. But boy, in Japan or Korea, it was a real challenge. And so leveraging what we learned from different geographies and bringing it into other geographies was helpful. That helped us a lot on gender diversity. I think when it comes to racism, we're in a little bit different ball game. And I described it earlier today. We had a webcast with our employees, but so I understand a little bit, very little, about what it might be like to have somebody say something about you or to be aggressive because you're gay, because I've been in situations like that. But I don't understand anything about what it feels like if you get in the car to drive to the grocery store and you're worried about getting pulled over for no apparent reason and getting harassed and hassled, or you got a child that's going out and you're in fear. Literally, they're going out and you're in fear for their life because you just don't know what's going to happen. And I have no real daily feel for what one of my African American colleagues must feel like, you know, when they live with that at home every day and then they have to come into work. And I want them to come into work and not worry about that and focus on their work and not be carrying that baggage. But how can they not carry that if that's, they spend more time living than they do at work? How can they not carry that around with them? And how can we not help them out and help lift them up and change that? And that, I think, is the toughest thing to get the white community to understand. That when we talk about white privilege, it's not meant to be that they did anything wrong to get where they are. But you just have to think about, how do we create an opportunity to give other people a chance? And what I said earlier today is, you got a population that's 90% doing well and successful and 10% feels oppressed, or 80-20. And you say to yourself, let's take a look at that economy and how that economy is functioning. How much better it would be functioning if the 20% that was oppressed wasn't oppressed and was actually performing and contributing and being rewarded and feeling like a part of that. I don't have to get an MBA to do the math for me on that. That's pretty simple. That's going to be a healthier, better functioning economy. And that's, I think, what we're trying to do is we're trying to lift up part of our community that is not feeling included and engaged right now.
Thank you for the question, Victor, and Jim, candidly, thank you for your response. I could listen and learn from you for hours. Unfortunately, we do have a time restraint on us, and I know you probably have other things to do other than and impart wisdom to our members. I'm going to shift gears here and go to what we call our lightning round. These are a little bit more personal, although I guess that's probably difficult to say based on the conversation we've had. But just curious, what's the last book that you read?
The Souls of Black Folks. I had a recommendation of one of my colleagues in Louisiana.
And how was it?
It was good, but it was also a little bit disheartening because in the time frame that it was written and the perspective that you read, turn of the century, and you look at today, you kind of walk away and realize there's not much difference between what was written then and what we're talking about now.
Yeah, that's definitely disheartening. And hopefully, I'm hoping that what we're going through is actually meaningful change, and that things will be different when we look back in a couple of decades or months or as soon as possible. Last song or album that you listen to intentionally? I know that we all get bombarded with music, but what sort of music do we calm down to? Or
Santana, Supernatural.
Excellent. Is that while you're working or working out or on the drive home?
Yeah, last night I was working out, so that's what it was last night. But it was, I was just in that kind of mood. Summertime, it just felt like that.
Nothing wrong with Santana, especially during the summer. What was your first paying job?
I grew up on a farm. My first paying job was hauling hay. And when I graduated from college, I stuck the hay hook into the pole of the barn, and I told my dad, that's the last of that.
What my wife grew up on a, my wife is Midwest, grew up in Iowa. She says it's not a farm, but certainly compared to what we have here in Boston, it is. What sort of farm was it? Is it?
We raised cattle, hogs, chickens.
That's some hard work. I know that coming in, putting in some hours at Dow is probably a bit easier.
Yeah, you get a good work ethic when you grow up in that environment.
There's no doubt about that. What's your favorite guilty food?
Ice cream.
Any particular type or flavor, or just ice cream?
It has to have some kind of chocolate in it.
Excellent. I like you even more. So I've got the workout with Santana followed by the chocolate fudge brownie ice cream. Is that
that's why we have, that's why we have to work out.
if you could meet one living person, who would it be and why?
I'm not Catholic, but I think I would like to meet the Pope. Just such a presence and such a powerful person. I think that would be an interesting meeting.
I feel like this is inside the actor's studio, but you meet the Pope, what would you say to him?
No, I would talk to him probably about, when he came into power, the work that he did on, he's been more open from an inclusion standpoint with the Catholic community than anybody else. But I think in terms of human decency and how people treat other people, he's done a lot there. And that's really what we're dealing with here. And I think this is a time where his message is very strong and very helpful.
That's great. And you led right into my last question. When you talked about the Pope's message, we try to end these sessions each time on a positive note, and we've asked each of our guests to share with us their message of hope, something that can sustain all of us during these challenging times, something that gives us optimism for the future. So I will pose to you, could you share with us and our members a message of hope for us to take away with us today?
Yeah, I think the pandemic has showed us just how interconnected the world is. And we're all trying to fight a virus. If we don't turn it into a political situation, what we're trying to fight is a disease. And if we can pull together and get the best solutions here, I think we can be victorious on that. And we're gonna show just how advanced we are from a medical standpoint in terms of being able to come up with a vaccine quickly to deal with this. It's the same challenge that we have on sustainability and climate change. What we do in one part of the world affects the other, and we're trying to tackle that. The toughest part of that challenge is not so much that we know what to do, but you have a developing economy that you've got 2 billion people coming onto the planet that need to develop as well, and you don't want to starve them of the ability to move up and have growth. And so a transitional plan that allows growth and addresses the climate change is going to be necessary. And I think if we allow those kinds of, and you know, diversity and racial equity are also things that we have seen have had the same kind of impact all around the world. Racial injustice started here. I mean, the tipping point was George Floyd's murder, but you've seen the response from around the world. It isn't here alone. And so you've seen tens of thousands of people out in many different countries asking for change. If we can just think about that and realize, you know, the impact that we have on each other, and say to ourselves, use this time when I said at the beginning, I think the pandemic was like God hit the big reset button here. Use this time to take out a clean sheet of paper and say, if you design the world that you want to live in 20 or 30 years from now, how do we take advantage of this time and this change? As Churchill said, never waste a good crisis. How do you take advantage of this time and this change when people's minds are in the right spot to make change and they're ready to make that change? How do we take advantage of it? I think we can do that, and then we can come out of this stronger. If our mindset is all we can do is wait till things get back to the way they were, that isn't going to move things forward. We have to take time to reflect and say, this is a time to reset and define the world that we want to live in 20 or 30 years from now. What does that look like?
Well, if that doesn't give us optimism moving forward, I don't know what is. And so I've been moved, and I'm going to take the liberty and say, on behalf of our members and those who are here, I want to thank you for your courage and your candor and your transparency. I think that the efforts that you have made and Dow has made on diversity, inclusion, on sustainability really should be a blueprint for all organizations. I know that the world needs more leaders like you today. And so I really appreciate your efforts in that regard, truly.
Thank you for the invitation today, Warren, and thanks, everybody. It's nice to talk to you. Thanks, Suzanne. Good to see you again, since I haven't been able to see you in person. We're glad to be part of the group and to be out there driving in new directions, but we need help and we need support.
Well, we look forward to when things opening up, you returning and joining us in Boston in person. Love to have you on our stage again. But again, on behalf of Boston College, the Carroll School of Management, and all of our members, thank you to everyone for joining us today for a conversation with CEO and Chair Jim Fitterling of Dow. Everyone have a wonderful day, and thank you again for being here.
We hope you enjoyed the podcast of the Boston College Chief Executives Club featuring Jim Fitterling, Chair and CEO of Dow. To learn more about the Boston College Chief Executives Club, a program of the Carroll School of Management at Boston College, please visit our website at www.bc.edu/CEO Club.